you, Maggie, for reading this morning's passage. You know it's going to be a bad sermon when somebody brings a table out as a barricade, right? Because we are talking about money. This morning feels like church to me rather than just worship. You know, we're connecting as a community. We are a family. We're caring for each other. We're encouraging each other to be faithful. All the things we're supposed to be as a fellowship. So thank you for entering in that way. And I'm just mindful again how hard it is to be a church, how hard it is to do good together, right? The thing that was on the screen. We want so easily to make it, here's the four simple things you get to do as a church and everything will work out just fine, but it's really messy, isn't it? Family is messy. So this morning, I need help. I'm so helpless today, it feels like. Is somebody willing to help me? I'm not going to tell you what. I just need somebody to come up here and be a tape dispenser. Justin, thank you. My life has felt really full, so I'm multitasking today. I can't even unroll tape, Justin. Maybe you can unroll tape for me. So Maggie read a text from 1 Timothy chapter 6, which is a book that many people don't like. 1 Timothy is written, we don't know exactly who wrote it. It may have been written by the Apostle Paul. Some people think that's the case. That's great. Thank you. Let's have it if we switch sides now. And some people think it was written by some of Paul's followers later on as a way of kind of continuing his message and his thoughts. And in either case, there's a sense that it really does resonate a lot with Paul's themes. He's talking about being the church and what does that look like. There's a connection between Paul and Timothy in the church of Ephesus. And there was a deep relationship between Paul and Timothy, and it's clear that Paul has this passionate concern for Ephesus as a church which embodies so many of the qualities you'd hope for in a church. It's a mix of a whole bunch of people, including rich and poor, which you'd hope that you could actually have in a church together, that folks could actually get along. There are people who have resources and people who don't have resources. And together, they try to figure out how do we live out the kingdom of God in a community where we're supposed to care for one another. And not just care for one another, but care for the people around us in our community as well. So one of the reasons that I like the pastoral epistles is that they're an example of a church community trying to figure this stuff out. They're trying to figure out, how do we do this? How do we love God and love our neighbor? How do we organize ourselves in a way that makes sense? How do we not get addicted to money and stuff? And so what the pastoral epistles try to do is to outline their sense of what that looked like in their particular context. You're awesome at this. I don't care what everyone's thinking right now. You're really good. And so they think about certain things, like within the Timothy epistles, they think about what does faithful leadership look like, what does sound teaching look like, you know, what we believe actually matters because it gives shape to how we live our lives. What does a good orderly function look like for a church? How do we be functional in what we're doing? How do we focus on the main things and not get distracted, in these epistles anyway, with two temptations that are constantly at work in our lives, sex and money, right? Sex and money, they're bound, if you get wrapped up in those, they'll lead you into trouble and all kinds of mischief. And so whoever wrote it, whether it was Paul or somebody else, is saying, don't get wrangled up in that, but stay focused on the things that really matter. And in the meantime, there's an order to this. No, sorry, to your left. Perfect. He writes to people who both have resources and don't have resources. And to the people who don't have resources, Paul says, basically, don't get swept up in your lust for money. Don't think that that's going to be the answer to all your problems. And also, don't believe that godliness leads to gain. That's kind of the early form of the health wealth gospel, right? If you're really faithful, then God will bless you with all kinds of resources. Paul really early on says that's not the case. So don't do that. But then he turns to the wealthy, and this text that we have from Timothy, and actually I'm going to steal a piece here. Because that's really important done right there. And he says, let's go this way. And he says basically, what's interesting is he doesn't reprimand the rich for having wealth resources, as if that's in of itself bad. Basically, he says, learn to be generous, share with others, within the community and without. Don't rely on your wealth, which is uncertain. It could be here today and gone tomorrow. Some of you saw that in 2008 when 25% of your retirement funds were suddenly gone, or your house plummeted, and you had worries. I had worries that people who don't have resources didn't have, right? Because suddenly the thing that they were relying on didn't suddenly disappear. So don't get swept up in that, but instead learn to nurture your trust in God. Learn to actually rely on the God who wants to bless you generously in this life, so that you can live the kind of life that you really are meant to live. You're really patient too, so thank you. Let's go this way. Right across there, straight. Later you're gonna go, why did he do that? Right? Why did he waste his time with that? But there will be a point to it later on. One more across here. Yep, perfect. So anyway, let me look at my notes here. He says, there's an encouragement to live out the plutos of God, to learn to be rich toward God. Rather than worrying about wealth, learn to be rich toward God. Well, what on earth does that mean? Again, it means to be generous. It means to take care of the people around you, of doing good with your resources. Of learning to be liberal, not in the sense of necessarily a political agenda, but learning to be open-handed, so that when somebody comes to you, you freely give, you meet the needs that are in front of you. And he encourages both rich and poor to take hold of this life. It's the same phrase Paul uses earlier in the chapter where he says, basically, take hold of the life that you have in Jesus Christ. Love that. Give your whole self to that. And he says the same thing in your desire to do good to others, because it's rooted in the same thing. We're called to grab onto it, to give it all the gusto we have, everything we have, in order to live this kind of life. Now, I'm often asked, because of my role in my other job, is, well, how much do I have to give? How much do I have to give in order to be generous? What does God really want from me? And so we create these silly things like, well, if you tithe, if you give 10%, then you're really faithful. And the Bible doesn't actually teach that. Tithing is one way to think about giving. I think what Paul talks about in Timothy is actually the better model. Be as absolutely generous as you can. Be as open-handed as you can, no matter where you are in the context of your life, because it's different for each one of us, isn't it? There's some in the church who don't have very many resources. There are others who have lots of resources. So how are each of we called to be generous within the context of community? Because that's the other part that Paul talks about in this. Let's go right across here. That's the other thing that Paul talks about in this chapter, is that you as the church are the oikos. You're a home, you're a family. And Paul takes his writings where he's talking about how an orderly nuclear family looks, and he connects it to the life in the church and says, church is just like that. You are a family as well. An oikos is a community that has a shared set of values and common interests. There's a deep economic relationship in it as well, because you're sharing resources as a family and you're committing yourselves to a particular way of life together. And so Paul wants the church to think about how it is that we are a family. How do we use our resources in a way that's focused in particular on doing the greatest good that we can do in the community? One more and then I'm going to set you free. Okay. Thank you. Oh my gosh, that ruined the whole thing right there. Jessica, do you mind going to the next slide? I like the way that the Cotton Patch version talks about it. It says, plead with the worldly rich not to be conceited nor to rest any weight on the mirage of wealth, but on God who liberally offers us everything needful for our well-being. Plead with them to do good, to be rich in noble deeds, to be sharers, to be full partners, assembling material for a fine foundation for the future, so they might hang on to the life that's real. It's this invitation that as this family of God, we will learn to do those very things. We'll focus on sharing. We'll focus on giving. An image that's been helpful for me over the years is the idea of coming to the table or being around the table together. That's what families often do. And years ago, when I was working for Friends United Meeting, I used an image of like this to talk about how it is that communities all have a share in the same life together. Sometimes when we think about church, we think about this as our budget. Like we need to meet the budget somehow, as if that's the great goal. We met our budget. Who cares if we met our budget? We're not called as a community to meet a budget. We're called as a community to do good, the most good we can possibly do together. And it's our good. It's Christ's good. It's not my good. It's all of us together. Each of us have a piece in this. And what I'd like you to think about this month, as we're talking about what we are called to do and who we are called to be as a community, is what's your piece in this? What's your piece in this? In your time and place, as a part of what we are called to do, how we can help the people that that Priscilla mentioned this morning, or some of the others that we prayed for today. How do we have the resources to do the greatest possible good we can? Not just keep the lights on, not just pay for our pastoral staff, but really think creatively about making a deep impact, being light in our community. So I used this image at Friends United Meeting. We had an annual budget of about $3 million a year, and so that was a lot of my work, was raising money. And I had this crazy idea that we should do a capital campaign. So we're going to raise an extra $3 million. And so I spent 2 years traveling around the world, talking to Quakers about money, giving money. And I used this image to say, to help us move from being a North American ministry, where North Americans got to decide everything that was going on in the world because we had all the money, to talk about how are we a global community? How do we invite everybody that's a part of this worldwide network of Quakers into the world? And so for a month, I traveled in East Africa, and for 30 straight days, I visited the homes of middle-class Tanzanians and Ugandans and Kenyans to talk about the work of Friends United in Guinea. And the overwhelming response I got from them was, how come nobody's ever asked us to participate in this? We want to participate in this. We want to be a part of this community. We want to be discerning what God is calling us to do, because we had changed the whole leadership structure so that it really was a global board. If denominations have a future at all, I think it's the fact that it puts us in contact with people who are different from us and push us to have to learn how to be the body of Christ together. And these folks were saying, we want to participate in that. We want to give. And I remember one sitting down with one couple in particular, And I used this image with them, and they both immediately teared up, and they said, "This is our local church." She was a retired judge. He was a retired CFO of an organization. They were doing pretty well by Kenyan standards. And they had donated the land that their church building was on. Now, when Kenyan Quakers typically start a church, they start by building a school for children, because that's the thing that they focus on. How do we educate the young people? How do we care for them? And then they started a clinic, because there are so many medical needs. They would meet outside and worship until they had enough resources to actually build a church building, because they had their priorities in a particular way. They were outward looking. So this family had donated the property for this mission that this church was doing. And they also donated a good bit of money. But they said one of the things that was so important to us was we had families who they had very few resources, but when we started putting the church building together, they each bought a window, and they brought it as a part of their commitment to our collective work. And when we got together for work days, there were some families who had very little, but they brought some maize to make ugali so that we could all eat together. That was their share. And I loved that image because it's not about the wealthy pushing their way. It's not about what I did, but it's about how all of us together, how all of us collectively have an opportunity to participate in what God is calling us to do. Now, this is an uncomfortable conversation, right? None of us like to talk about money. We have a very strong taboo about money talk. We rarely talk about money here at North Valley, which is funny to me, but it's true. It's part of our history. We just sort of assume everybody will give. When I became a Christian, when I was in my 20s, I had no idea how churches functioned. So I showed up, and I put my $3 in the pot, came by, and it was magic. All this stuff happened. And the church took care of me. They blessed me in so many amazing ways. Seriously, it changed my life. All on $3 a week by me. It was amazing. and then I got more involved, and I realized that, oh, there's a lot of stuff that happens here. They're helping a lot of people. And I started having conversations, talking with people, and I realized there were some people who were giving thousands of dollars to the work of the church. And those people never shamed me, they never did anything, it was just part of who we are together. And so later on, Janine, when we first got married, Janine wasn't a Christian, and so we had to have some conversations about how much money we would give. And she didn't feel so comfortable about giving lots of money to something she didn't believe in, and I totally respected that and understood that. So I gave $25 a week for a long time, until Jenny came to faith. And then she got really excited about it and wanted to give a lot more. And I thought, I'm not sure I feel comfortable with you having faith. And so, but we started giving more. And honestly, and I'm gonna say more than you're probably maybe comfortable with, but when we came to North Valley, you were the first church that gave us any retirement benefits. I've been a pastor for a number of years. You were super generous that way. And that was really helpful for us because we had no retirement. And I'm really grateful for that as a commitment to you, the pastoral staff that you have here. We also at that time received some inheritance money, and it allowed us to have some money to make a down payment on the house we live in now. And so it helped us minimize some of our housing costs so we could give more generously. I recognize that lots of young families these days are struggling under the weight of housing. Right? I get that. And that was something that wasn't an issue for us, so we were able to give more. So we made a commitment of trying to give 10% of our income. Not because I think there's magic in that, but just because that seemed like what we could do. And sometimes we gave more, and sometimes we gave less, and sometimes we've always given stuff beyond North Valley. But this is a primary commitment for us because this is our family. And we sense that we are called to do stuff with you, and we want to invest in that. And so now, fast forward many years later, I'm an old guy, and I'm making more money, not a lot, but I'm making more money than I ever have. Janine and I are both working some, so we're able to do more than we used to be able to do, and we feel really good about that. And we're not going to be here forever, right? And that's part of where churches are always kind of trying to navigate that sort of stuff. I mean, we're thinking, we're trying to also think about lots of stuff. How do we support our kids more now at this stage of their life when they really need the money rather than later on when we're dead, right? Most of my kids make more money than I do already, but they could use the money now than they will later. So we're trying to figure all that out, just as I know all of you are trying to figure that out. So part of my encouragement for us in this next month is there's going to be an opportunity not to make a pledge, because we don't do pledges here, but to encourage each of you to think about your intentions for the coming year, because we are saying we want to do some new stuff in this next year. And so imagine for yourself is, what's your piece in this? And don't do any more than that, because it's not resting on your shoulders to make our community work. Don't do any less than that. What simply is God calling you to do in this time and place so that we together can do the greatest possible good? Let's spend some time.